Hi, everyone. This is Zachary Hoskins with another episode of the Dance Music Sex Romance Podcast. And I am here today with Chambers Stevens, who I think you have, first of all, Chambers, if you don't mind sharing on the record, I think everyone should know why we're starting this podcast a little later than expected.
You mean like after the Manchester conference that we were asking?
Yes.
Well, I am blessed to be in a band called the Band of Merrymakers, which is a super kind of super group. A Christmas charity group that raises money for Music Cares, and they have members from Fitz, from all different kinds of bands that are in it. And we are opening the Christmas parade at Hollywood Christmas Parade, okay? And we have a big performance tomorrow with the Village People, okay? Now, I have to say this, that because it's very important, there's actually a battle of the Village People. Okay, there are actually two Village People groups. One, my friend Bill is in, which played the Hollywood Bowl, okay? And they've been touring for like 20 years, okay? And then I guess one of the Village People started to do his own Village People, and now Battle of the Village People. We're on Bill with the other Village People at the Hollywood Christmas Parade, and we just got finished doing the sound check. Donnie and Marie were there, so it was like,
oh my God,
a lot of Eric Estrada, and guess who the Grand Marshal is? Dr. Oz.
After Eric Estrada, I can't even guess.
Dr. Oz, can you believe that? That is some serious clout right there on the Hollywood Christmas Parade, okay?
Yeah.
It's like a low-rent Macy's parade, you know? So,
yeah.
So we were supposed to do this earlier, and thank you so much for, helping me out and doing a little bit later because of that.
Well, I got your email, and it was the best reason to be late. I've heard it's like the Village People are taking so much time at rehearsal. Like,
yeah, well, I haven't sung those songs in a long time, so that's all I can really say on the record. Okay,
right. So thank you so much for taking the time. I think this will be fun.
Zach, I love your podcast. I just want you to, before we start, listen, if you're listening to this podcast and I'm episode, I don't know, 10 or 11 or something, and you know how fantastic this podcast is. It's smart. It's intellectual. It takes something that we all love, Prince, and it takes it to a whole new kind of level of thinking about, you know, this man and the creative work he has done. And I am so honored to be on your show.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Yeah. You don't have to flatter me when you come on, but it doesn't hurt.
So. It doesn't hurt, right? Right. Yes. Well, I was talking to Dwayne. My buddy Dwayne was on, like, I guess, like last week, you know?
Yeah, last episode.
Wonderful book. Yeah. We were talking about, you know, what a great interview you are and how much fun it is to think of Prince in this way.
Yeah, I had a great time talking to Dwayne, and obviously his book is fantastic.
It is so fantastic. Right.
Yeah. So we've been trying to schedule this for a little while. I know Chambers. I think I've just seen you around on Facebook and stuff. I think you're in Dwayne's group, so I've been aware of you as, like, you know, a name. And then I heard in my series of interviews that I did with people who were at the conference earlier this year, I heard about a presentation that was looking at Prince from the perspective of his acting and, from the perspective of someone who is a trained actor. I thought, well, that's interesting. It just so kind of happens that Chambers ended up contacting me and was like, I was that guy. So, it's great, 'cause now I get a chance to kind of hear what you had to say in Manchester. And I know that we have some other things to talk about also.
Well, I knew that they were not going to, there's a lot of amazing, intellectuals that got to go to Manchester, and there's a lot of incredible musicians who can talk about his use of jazz chords backwards and frontwards. And I knew there was no way in hell they were going to let me speak about something like that. And so I thought, okay, what is the one thing that they probably don't know? And when I started reading the books about various things about Prince, I realized, you know what? This guy had acting lessons before he did Purple Rain. And so I dug into what those acting lessons were, and that's how I came up with the theory.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Prince is somebody who, I mean, his movies, even the good ones, even the ones that I really enjoy, you know, they weren't great movies. He's not very widely respected as an actor, even to the degree that, you know, maybe like David Bowie was. I do think that you know, that might explain why people aren't talking about it, but I think that there's something there, because so much of his ability to kind of project himself on stage and in his music videos and in film also, you know, I think does stem from that training that he received. And it was a long time ago, and I don't have the comment pulled up in front of me, so I can't give credit for it, but someone on my blog, I think it was the post about his first concert at the Capri Theater in 1979, and someone on the blog was like, "Okay, well, you know, this is interesting, but when did the transformation happen? Like, if this first show was, you know, not that impressive, when did Prince become Prince?" And I don't have a definitive answer for that, but I think that there's a case to be made that Prince became Prince in this sort of like boot camp that he participated in before Purple Rain. It's where he learned how to, you know, really dance. It's where he learned how to kind of, you know, project this larger than life image that I think is what we've seen from him ever since.
Yeah, I think you're right. Can I just tell you a little bit about my history, you know, like with the man?
Yes, and, please do. Yeah, let's do it.
So I'm a little bit older than most of the people that are on your show. And I saw the Purple Rain tour and the Love Sexy tour. And I'm from Nashville, Tennessee. I was raised in the kind of the country music world there. My parents were not country music people, but we were raised. Johnny Cash was a sponsor of my little league baseball team. Okay, so I kind of lived in this little, you know, country world, and I'm a clogger. I'm into bluegrass music and stuff, and I like to disco dance as a kid, and because dancing is dancing, that's kind of how I found myself as learning how to dance. And then, of course, Michael Jackson kind of loved to, you know, we all kind of loved the Thriller album back in junior high. And then when the Jacksons decided to make the album, the Victory album, where all the brothers together, I was working at Domino's Pizza back in that day, and my buddies and all decided we'd get the album the day it came out, get the cassette, and we'd meet in this park at like 10 o'clock at night, and we'd dance to it all night. And we invited our best girls to come, and went to the store and picked it up early in the morning, because I was driving around all day delivering pizza, and I brought a $20 bill, and they said, "Hey, you have enough money to get another cassette." And they said, "Why don't you get that cassette of that guy over there? He's riding the purple motorcycle." And I'm like, "Okay, I'll get the Prince and the Revolution." And I promised that I would wait to open the Victory album, the Jacksons album, when all my friends were around. I would not listen to it in advance. And of course, you know, you put that on.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else. The afterworld. A world of never-ending happiness. You can always see the sun, day or night. So when you call up that shrink in Beverly Hills, you know the one. Doctor, everything will be alright. Instead of asking him how much of your time is left, ask him how much of your mind, baby. Cause in this life, things are much harder than in the afterworld. This life, you're on your own. And if the elevator tries to break you down, go crazy. Punch a higher floor.
I was raised in Tennessee, a Christian. I had started having sex with my girlfriend, and there was this kind of tension about that. And here is this album, which is exactly about that.
It's made for you, yeah.
You know, and my father also was a car salesman. He sold Senator Gore, Albert Gore, a car. Of course, that's a big thing, the Darling Nikki, you know, song and, you know, that whole thing. So I was, like, right in the center of that. And I listened to it all day, like, over 10 times. And by the time we got to the park, we put on the Victory album. Of course, it's not a very good album. We were all disappointed. And I said, well, wait till you guys hear what I hear. And so I did that. And the next day, on the way home that night, late at night, I pulled up to an intersection, and there's a woman next to me who was picking her nose. Okay. And I was looking at her, like, what are you doing? And she saw me looking, and she pulled out into the middle of the intersection to avoid being embarrassed that I caught her picking her nose, and made two cars smash into each other. And okay. I was like, it was like, you know, like 2 o'clock in the morning, and the police came, and she took off, and they wanted to get witnesses and stuff. And the next day I went back to work at Domino's, and they had a new manager, and I walked in, and the manager was the woman who was picking her nose. And she saw me, and she's like, oh, come here. And she like, took me back in the like, you know, office. And she said, listen, we're not going to speak about what we saw yesterday. I know you would like to, you know, I know you'd like to, you know, get better hours, and I'm going to give you better hours. And basically she started giving me all the things I kind of wanted, you know, at 19 years old, the job. And I said, perfect. And so I walked out, and as I walked out, I passed her car, and I saw in the back all these cassettes of Prince. And I walked back in, and I said, and I want those cassettes too. Because I didn't even know Prince had that many cassettes. And so immediately she said, white boys got some taste. And so immediately I had all the complete cassettes of the time and everything in order to avoid telling anyone that I'd seen her pick her nose and that she had made these two cars smash into each other. Now, I've just taken your intellectual podcast down to a whole bad level. but you need to know the truth. And so then I like saw Prince and I saw him in concert, and this is Murfreesboro, Tennessee, which is really close to Nashville. That's where Dez moved, and so Dez would do concerts. You know, and then we had a little club, a really tiny little club, and Maserati would come, okay, and perform there. Okay, I saw them perform twice, and then when I moved to Los Angeles, I saw, of course, that was when his club, Grand Slam, L.A. opened. And I got to see him a lot there. And I got to see the famous concert in which he pretended to have the flu, which I always thought he had the flu until I read Maite's book. And she said that, you know, that was the night that she really suspected that he might have had a drug problem. And that was the night at the Pantages. And then I saw him. And then he did the 21 nights, and I saw most of those at the Forum. And so we got to see him a lot, and it was an amazing experience kind of doing that. And then I had kind of a really amazing experience in 2000, I guess it was 2004, when he decided to do the musicology tour. He did his first press conference in like a long, long time, and he sent an email to his fans, to about 50 of us, and told us to bring, he was a little nervous and he hadn't done one in a long time, and to please bring a friend to the El Rey at like, I think it was the El Rey was the club, and it was at like 10 o'clock in the morning. He was going to do his first Prince conference. I mean, not conference, what I'm going to say, yeah, press conference. And he said, please just make sure that you understand I'm not going to play. And so we went there with each of us brought a friend. There was like 100 people and like 40 press, and he walked out and he seemed very nervous, and he started talking about this new musicology tour he was going to do. And, you know, he always said he's going to play these songs for the last time. That was his kind of shtick, you know?
Right.
And then but we believed it every time. We totally believed it. And then he answered like a couple of questions, and he said, you know what? It's just better if I show you. And the curtains opened, and he, and the NPG was there, and he started to play. And then he said, I think I need some dancers. And I remember jumping up in the air, and my friend got under me and passed me to the front of the stage. And so I stayed on the front of the stage with Prince the entire time. And I saw tons of photographers, and that was that famous picture in Life magazine of Prince dancing. And then I'm right behind him in that picture. And so that was kind of a great moment in my life to be on stage with him and, feel that energy and it wasn't like we were on stage for one song like they did in the musical. We were on stage for the entire concert just dancing behind him.
Wow. Yeah.
So then Prince and I had a little moment. Something happened between us in that moment. And okay. I'm an acting coach mainly for young people. Okay. I coach a lot of young people. And he's the world's greatest performer in the world. In my book, one of the greatest songwriters, producers, and he loves children. But when it comes to whether children like Prince better or me, they like me better. And there was a kid on stage, and the kid thought I was the funniest dancer in the world. And Prince could not understand why this kid was looking at this fat white guy and not him. Okay? And he really was not nice to me on stage at all. Okay? And everyone else was really nice, and he was playing and looking at me and trying to get the kid's attention, and the kid thought I was hilarious. He was laughing at me. And so Prince was, like, very cold to me on that stage. A couple of months later, the same group of people, we were all asked to be in a music video of Prince's. I believe it was around, maybe it was like almost a year later. And we showed up to the studio, and we're all waiting in line. We were already dancing in the music video, and we heard this screaming and yelling, and Prince had gotten there, and they had built the stage way too small, that only big enough for him and no dancers. So they came and they told us that we were going to have to leave, and that they were sorry. And all of a sudden, there's in walks Prince, and he looks at all of us, and then he walks right up to me, and he says, "I'm sorry." And in that moment, Zach, I knew he was talking about that kid on the stage, okay? Not that music video, okay?
Right.
And I said, "That's okay." And then he turned and he said, "Really, everyone I didn't know is going to be built so small, and I really appreciate your coming." And then he just turned and left. And so that's kind of like, you know, and we went to Manchester. We found out that many times Prince would, say things like, "Oh, my gosh." I mean, one woman was telling a story about how Prince was so excited that this family, had tried to get pregnant for so many years, and now they were finally going to have a baby. And I was like, "Oh my gosh!" You know, my wife and I were trying to get pregnant for a long time. And he would like go on the internet and kind of like, we wouldn't know it was him, but he would talk to us about things. You know what I mean? And these
right.
chat rooms and stuff. And so, you know, there's lots of evidence that I could just be crazy, but there's lots of evidence that he kind of knew a lot about his fans and the ones that really loved him.
Well, that's interesting. Even just, part of the email about the press conference and everything, it ended up being like a classic, Prince bait and switch, where like now it's a reveal. He is performing, but there's something so kind of like endearingly vulnerable about one of the biggest, superstars in the world saying to his fans, like, "I'm nervous. I haven't done a press conference in, 5 years or whatever."
But yeah, and we always believed him. And we totally believed him. If you look back at those Uptown magazines, he would say, "Yeah, I'm making a movie about blank." And we believe him. And then, of course, that movie never, how many times that happened? Over, 100 times?
Right, yeah.
He had something. You read those magazines back, there's like 100 projects you never even ever heard of again.
Yeah.
But maybe he gave you 100 more, so you can't really complain, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, you are, I think, the second person I've spoken to who has been in the same room as Prince, not accounting like a concert venue. So
right.
So yeah.
Well, he's, it was, I was nervous when I was on stage with him, and then I saw on the bottom of his hem that they did not hem his pants, and he was actually standing on them with his heels, and they had worn a little on the bottom. And when I saw that, I thought, "Oh my God, he's a human." Okay.
Right.
And then of course he had a monitor, and even, the song's like, "Let's Go Crazy," he would glance down at the monitor, and I was like, "Oh my gosh, all of the fans that are on the stage, we know every single word to every single song that he's singing." And he's like, has the monitor, he has 1,000 songs. We don't have that many. So there you go. Oh,
Everybody one.
Let's talk a little bit, if you don't mind, let's talk a little bit about this this perspective on Prince as an actor.
Well, okay, there was always something that bothered me about, well, first of all, I'm a playwright also, and I wrote a play, and I won a playwriting contest. I actually co-won it. I won... They decided to give it to two playwrights instead of one. And my play about Twain, Mark Twain, won. And also a play by William Blinn, who also wrote the movie Purple Rain, won.
Yeah.
Okay? Yeah. So I got to hang out with him a short period of time. And he was talking about hiring. And so I got to ask him like three questions. And he told me that he had hired this acting coach, you know, to train Prince and the Revolution and the time for the film Purple Rain. Okay? And right. I, you know, there's a lot of the word acting coach, you know, like can mean different things. And like in television, often an acting coach can mean just person to help you learn your lines. And sometimes an acting coach can be what he was basically saying. He was actually not using the word correctly. He was actually hiring Prince and the Revolution at the time an acting teacher. Okay, he was actually teaching them how to act. And so in all the books, they talk about Don Amendola having this, you know, film experience, and he, you know, he'd been on Cheers and Ryan's Hope and stuff like that. But when I looked up the man, I noticed that those things had happened after Purple Rain, not before. Okay.
Yeah.
So that actually Mr. Amendola, Dolia had really not had that much film experience himself, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the cool part about Minneapolis being so close to Chicago, and Chicago, of course, is the hotbed of improv, is that,
right?
And I started to kind of see the kind of exercises, you know, through little interview sections that he had possibly done, okay? Mm-hmm. And so I based this whole idea that he had taught Prince and the Revolution improv. Okay, and which of course is the whole idea of yes and. So if I say you and I are doing improv, and I'm going to go kind of basic here, so in case someone doesn't really, I've never heard this concept before. But basically, if I'm standing somewhere and I'm pretending to fish, and you walk up and you're like, hey, you know, you have to immediately. If I say, hey, I'm so glad you came. I'm so glad you brought your fishing pole. You can't say, no, I didn't bring my fishing pole. You have to say, yes, yes, I brought my fishing pole. And guess what? I brought, and you have to add something to it. That's the and part. Yes, and I brought a cat as bait to bait. And there you start the, you know, thing, right? So we have this whole thing about yes and I thought that, I bet that was what Prince did. Now, I worked really hard to get in touch with this acting coach. He doesn't live that far from me, but it proved much, much harder than I had thought. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to go to Manchester and based on a whole theory, and I'm going to have no backup. You know what I mean? I'm basically guessing. You know, and then a week before
that sounds like an academic conference.
Yeah, you know, this is my very first academic conference. Okay? I have my bachelor's. I think I was like the only person in Manchester who had a bachelor's. Okay, everyone else has doctors and masters, and I was like, okay, Chambers, what are you going to do? You have this great theory. The whole thing is wonderfully laid out, but you actually have no proof but a couple of lines. And then somebody sent me a piece of paper that said that Jill Jones, who's in the movie Purple Rain, is performing three blocks from my house at this club called The Study, which looks like a study, which I never knew existed. And she's going to do a performance and talk back. So I go.
There you go.
You know, and actually, Dwayne, you know, he goes too, and we go, and she actually, she sings all of her album, which we you know, every Prince fan loves, and we consider one of Prince's best protege albums. I'm sure you love that album too. And then, so she says, any questions? And I start asking her questions to back up my, you know, thing. I'm going to leave in like 3 days for England. And it turns out that it actually the things that I guessed had happened and actually indeed had happened. Okay. And then we started to come with the idea is, you know, we all know what a control freak he was. Okay. And if you're in the Revolution and you have to do everything he says, and yet you're in an acting class, you cannot, you, if Prince, if Prince walks into your improv and you say, hey, I brought a fishing pole, you, Prince has to go with it. So what happened is these yes and exercises actually led to the revolution becoming tighter.
Yeah, huh. How interesting is that? Right.
Isn't that pretty amazing? Okay. And that's basically how it all kind of, you know, happened. And so they, you know, and they did these exercises over and over again. And you know, Prince, you know, Don Amendola had this thing. He said Prince was very, very good. He slipped right in and out of his persona and be any character he had to be. He's very shy, but as most actors are to a degree, but he also asks a lot of questions. And, you know, I said, you know, so you can see how improv would really help, because Amendola said that Prince is not being himself, but a persona. So quick improv makes you leave your false personality, because you can't be a false personality over and over again in improv. It's too exhausting. Okay. He said Prince was shy. Improv creates a yes space because everything is yes and. Okay. He says that Prince asks a lot of questions, which means Prince is in his head. He's not in his body. He's not in his heart. Improv is impossible to do if you're asking questions. In fact, the rule of improv is there are no questions. Everything has to be a statement. So the things that Prince had done up until this moment and that he had done and as his insecurity, the improv that Don did actually got rid of those things, okay? And what I think happens is the reason the movie is so good is because you see them kind of just rocking it, okay, and making it happen. And I think you see that even in Under the Cherry Moon, because his buddy Jerome, they're improvising a lot of that stuff in that movie. Yes, and, okay?
Right.
So I thought that was pretty cool. And then here was the part that is the most interesting part. I'm not a big fan of an acting technique called the Meisner technique, okay? And I think it is a fantastic technique, okay? But it is a technique that takes a very, very long time to master and get results from. You can't take a weekend class in Meisner and get something from it. And Jill all of a sudden says that by the time they got to Graffiti Bridge, that he was obsessed with Meisner, which is a lot of repeating and intellectual work. And let me ask you, is his performance better in Purple Rain or Graffiti Bridge?
It is so much better in Purple Rain.
Well, there you go. See, that technique, he went to that technique because that went back to his insecurities. Okay. And there you go. Okay.
Yeah. that's so interesting. For you know, those of us who don't know, so Meisner, you said it's sort of a more intellectual, more cerebral.
Listen, I mean, Meisner teachers would disagree with me about this, but here is one of the things about it. Okay, is back in the '50s when most of these techniques were developed, men and women kept their emotions, you know, they tightly inside themselves. So these Strasberg and these techniques are to break them down and so that they can eventually, in Meisner, you repeat a lot. You repeat things over and over again until you finally just kind of break down and you reveal yourself. Okay.
Okay.
But
sort of methody.
Yeah, it's one of the three techniques we consider the method, okay? And it's based on part of Stanislavski's work, okay? Now, here's the cool, the weird part about it, though, is if you don't have that much time, then you're just repeating things over and over again. Plus, now when people come into my studio, they don't have any barriers. They tell me way too much about their life. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They tell you most intimate things in the first 10 minutes. I'm like, okay, stop talking for a second. Let's get this together. So the acting technique is maybe not, you know, many great actors use this technique. Some of the greatest actors in the world have used this technique, but it's not a technique the person can just dabble in. Okay.
Right.
And that's what Prince was obviously trying to do. Plus, you know, you were talking about David Bowie. David Bowie worked with some fantastic directors, okay? And the one weakness that we can say about our man Prince is that that was not his skill, okay? And so therefore,
Albert Magnoli was the best director he worked with, I think.
Yeah, so, and, you know, and Exactly. That was the best director he worked with. And after that, you know, there you go. Okay?
Right.
And so what do you do?
Come, the fire comes, let everyone burn. We're always a big sound and learn that we need each other. Come.
This is the dawning of a new spiritual revolution.
But I saw the Yes And. The Yes And was actually, I think that actually fed his music also, because, you know, mm-hmm. that made all these experimental things happen. And, you know, why not? You know, I mean, one of the things that's great about Dwayne's book is that Dwayne's book is about Prince is not a perfectionist. Prince is right. putting the music on tape, and that feeling of freedom that Yes And will put this on is what makes mm-hmm. us love the music so much.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think that that's a really important distinction, you know, because I think people assume that because Prince was such a studio-based artist that that he must have been a perfectionist. But I mean, there's a huge difference, and I'm not trying to cast any aspersions here, but there's a huge difference between Prince's studio music and, you know, like Steely Dan. Like Steely Dan, that's a band that those guys are perfectionists, and I actually like Steely Dan, but they're not Prince, you know.
So no, exactly. I totally agree.
It's totally different.
And in LA, we saw things too that other people didn't get a chance to see, where he was just out there. I mean, do you know the story of the Glenn Slam Ulysses? Do you know that thing?
I know of it. I don't know a lot.
So Prince I'm very interested created in this hybrid dance theater piece loosely right. based on Homer's The Odyssey.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, now so obviously so Prince somehow related to Homer's The Odyssey, whether I'm sure he read they said he read a lot of books, so I'm sure he read yeah. you know, and then he wrote Glenn Slam Ulysses, which has a lot mm-hmm. of songs from the Come album and I think from Gold too. Okay. And yeah. you know, and talk about the biggest Yes And thing you've ever seen in your life. Okay. The show is like a big glorious mess. It's exciting right. and dynamic, outrageous, at the same time, you know, doesn't make a bit of sense. You know,
right.
it's like, and he just said, like, I'm going to just try this and put it all together, you know? So I think that, and, you know, my grandmother always said, takes a lot of manure to grow roses. And I think that, you know, I love the Come album, and the Come album is better than Glenn Slam Ulysses. And so therefore, it's kind of like, you know, he had to make a lot of manure too to make some of these amazing things that he also made.
You really kind of look at his unreleased music in a totally different way when you're thinking about it as, you know, this was like a laboratory, basically. A lot of these songs are not outtakes in the way that we think of outtakes from an artist being. A lot of the time he's literally just making it up as he goes along. And, you know, with that in mind, it's all that much more astonishing that a lot of this work that wasn't released is as good as it is.
Yeah, no, no.
And is worth listening to.
I think you're exactly right. I think that's kind of, you know, and you know, I one thing that really drew me to you is when you started to, you know, you put musical interludes between things. And some of those interludes are really deep in the catalog, as the kids say. You know what I mean? And sometimes you'll bring up really obscure songs that I'm like, wow, you know, only hardcore people know what you're talking about there. And and so, you know, Dwayne has done a great job of starting that with his first book here. And I think right. that, you know, I think we're going to even see more and more of these. We heard a little bit on the 10 or so tracks on the new Purple Rain remaster album. But there is, yeah. you know, and these songs seem like Yes And. I mean, Yes And I'm going to add this, and Yes, I'm going to put this into it. And if you look at almost Under the Cherry Moon, I mean, Around the World Today, Yes, I'm going to add these instruments from other countries and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, I would be curious, like, now thinking about this, I'm interested in you know, maybe listening. I don't know how many, you know, part of the problem with this is I think a lot of like rehearsals didn't start being recorded or at least not leaked until after Purple Rain, you know, but I would be curious in trying to track down a pre-Purple Rain rehearsal and a post-Purple Rain rehearsal. And I do wonder, like, how does the dynamic differ? Because I do think it's interesting to think about, you know, what is the agency of the other people in this band when you're in a band that is driven by someone who is, you know, can play any instrument, you know, as good and often better than the other people in the band.
No,
has
right.
a really clear idea of what he wants to do musically, comes to him very quickly. You know, I mean, how do you not just become, you know, like a performing machine for this guy? And I think that this improv theory makes sense to me. It is kind of a way to, like, you know, let me introduce this, let me throw a riff in here and see if he'll take it and run with it. And I know that I've heard post Purple Rain rehearsals. I've absolutely heard that.
Right. Where they start something and they keep going, you know?
Yeah.
But if you think about it, it's also this mixture of one other thing, and that is he was fiercely competitive. Okay, mm-hmm. And we in Manchester
we saw that with your story.
Yeah, right, and yeah, and we, you know, and you saw that with my story, and you know, Dez talked about that. How Dez said that he was a better guitar mm-hmm. player than Prince when they first started, and you know, and Prince would practice all the time, so he could never let, you know, he could never let him be as good. He didn't want ever Dez to be better than him.
Right,
you know. You know, I had never heard of Prince's cousin Chaz. You know, I'm talking about Chaz. I think his last name maybe Smith.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, he was Charles also mm-hmm. at the conference, and he told this story that Levi was a guy that they used to look up to a lot. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go to Levi. You know, Levi actually ended up becoming in Prince's band, and he
right.
They would go to his house. And they would, he like had a basement, he played in the basement of his house, and they would lay down in the little window, which is at ground level, and listen to Levi play when they were kids, and then they would go, shit, he's better than us, and then they'd go home and practice. Okay? And, you know, I have also another paper coming out soon, and actually, I'm sure you know the Prince book, that's the African Studies Prince book that's coming out. I think they put
yes.
together. I have a story about the actual competition between him and Jesse Johnson that's coming out in that the
oh.
new book.
And oh, how, I can't wait to read that.
And how he
yeah,
would call Jesse and he would
story.
Say, like, your new album sucks, you know, and,
yeah.
and how he would, you know... He would, like, you know, made the song Shakadelica because you know that story, right? About Jesse.
Right, right.
People who don't know that story, Jesse made an album called Shakadelica, but did not make a song called Shakadelica. And when Prince heard that there was that Jesse's new album called Shakadelica was coming out, Prince, in a classic dick mood, recorded a song called Shakadelica. Okay,
yeah, a really good song,
a really great song, yeah. and you know, but you know what? And so Jesse topped Prince by taking one of mm. Prince's, you know, heroes, Sly Stone, and recording a duet mm-hmm. with him.
Yeah.
So, you know, they kind of like, you know, they kind of upped each other, you know what I mean? And that kind of competition between him and Jesse and, you know, because Susan Rogers often says that, you know, people often think that Prince was, you know, really competitive with Michael Jackson, but that really Prince rarely thought about Michael Jackson.
Right.
But he really thought about Jesse and how Jesse could tear it up. You know what I mean?
Mm.
And he didn't want Jesse to ever get better than him. And that competition made Prince better.
Just wanna feel ya, I just wanna feel ya, yeah.
you see some of that with Andre Simone also. I mean, there definitely is this strain. It almost seems bizarre for someone who I think most people, just including a lot of these people that he was competitive with, just think of Prince as, like, you know, untouchable. And but he was extremely self-conscious, but the great thing was that it drove him to, like you said, to get better. And it also, he was also just, like, insanely petty. Like, some of these stories are so, like, it's just incredible that grown man could be this petty.
No, you're exactly right. And he was also young. And, you know,
that is
and
true.
People don't, I mean, you know, people were scared to speak about him when he was alive because they didn't want to be sued.
Right.
I mean, one reason. And then, right, you know, now that he's dead, they don't want to speak ill of the dead. But I think showing that he's a man is what makes him interesting, okay? Not that he's some kind of icon god. People are always voting on, you know, vote for Prince to be the icon of the whatever. You know, he was a man who had flaws is what makes his music so much more beautiful, and that he was trying to find himself, and he became the soundtrack of many of our lives. And you know, as Dwayne said, I believe, on your show, it's like sometimes you hear albums that you just, like, you know, I mean, God, I can barely listen to Rainbow Children because of that horrible story that I, you know, and but, you know, some of those fast songs on that album are the best songs he ever wrote.
And maybe that is part of, you know, kind of going back to what Dwayne and I were talking about. And I think this might be a segue into, you know, some other things that we were thinking about discussing. You know, maybe this is one reason why Prince's music can be so intimate to his fans, because there is that's even though, you know, ironically, a lot of fans don't like acknowledging this, but he was very human, and he had human frailties, and you can see that transparently, you know, just in the fact that someone who is so sublimely talented was also, you know, jealous enough of the time that he would take them off the bill if he thought that they were getting too good, you know, those kinds of stories. And I think, even though it's sort of like, maybe it hurts an idol worship kind of approach to him, I wonder if that makes it sort of brings him closer. You know, maybe that's a part of why we connect with his music more than we would if he was this sort of untouchable, you know, unknowable thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, I spoke in Manchester at 3:00. And on the first day, and no one, to my knowledge, of any room I was in, said one single negative thing about him until 3:00.
Right.
And I was like, okay, I hope I don't get kicked out of this place, because, you know, I'm getting ready. And my thing was, you know, when my mother died when I was in my 20s, and I had in a car accident. And so I was in charge of putting her funeral together. And she always wanted me to speak if I ever look at her funeral, and I'm an actor. So I just gave this incredible, you know, speech and, about her life and stuff. And I didn't cry at all, even though she'd been killed in this accident. And when the funeral was over, it was nighttime, and I decided to go walking by myself in Nashville, and they were having an outdoor concert. And this woman was playing a song about this old shirt that she had, and had how a cat had given birth on that old shirt, and one of the cats had died, and I couldn't stop crying for like an hour. And, you know, that was, you know, I tell you like this intimate story about myself because I understand in moments of crisis, when my mom's funeral, I had this impulse that I wanted to perform, but, you know, and I wanted to make her happy. So there's always been this moment in Prince's life that true fans have secretly discussed, and we never want to tell other people about. And Maite, of course, did it in her book, which is the birth of his son. And it's not the birth of his son that's so unusual, because that is just horrible, but that a couple days later they shot the Betcha by Golly Wow video of that, you know. And of course, in the video, he's reenacting that he's at the gas station and he gets the message from his wife to come to the doctor's office where she tells him that she's pregnant. And, mm-hmm. you know, this has happened. They're filming this days after their little son right. has died. And
right.
this has always bothered many of us secretly about that. And, she had to get out of bed. She was paralyzed from grief and, you know, it was hard to understand. And then I started to think about this from the improv idea, and it made sense for once. Prince may have been thinking, yes, my son has passed away, and I'm going to remember the moment I found out he was going to be born. I'm going to celebrate that moment. I'm going to relive that joy.
Yeah.
And therefore, it is a beautiful video, okay? And that that may be those little acting classes he took in the summer of 1983, maybe that was the way he was able to deal with the most tragic moment of his entire life.
Right. Right. Yeah, and his, you know, it's a shame because, I mean, having read Maite's book, it's obvious that, you know, that was not what she needed to deal with that. But his coping strategies were just so specific to him. And it is almost like he had to do this at that. And just like, and he had to, you know, go on tour. He had to kind of throw himself into that. And I can't, you know, I can't even imagine going through that experience.
Yeah, I think, you know,
that part of the book really wrecked me.
Right. And I think we also, you know, I mean, we have to remember in that tour thing too, is that he had a lot of employees that depended on him for money. And, you know,
right.
he no longer had a contract and he was doing something that no one else had done before. You know what I mean? And, you know, right. and let's right. talk about that whole thing, too, about competitiveness. I mean, the whole damn reason that he got into all the mess with this whole, you know, people get so mad at Warner Brothers, but that was because he was mad about Madonna, or was it Mariah Carey, one of those two, scoring a bigger record deal than him.
Yeah.
I think it might have been Janet Jackson, actually, and which, of course, adds up the whole case that Janet Jackson had scored a bigger record deal than him, which brings it to the point of Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, members at the time, which he gets fired. You know? And he had, you know, and I understand that he, you know, he hated not losing the Masters and stuff, but he's the one that made that whole record deal. He's the one that felt like he had to make it. Alan Leeds talks about that, you know what I mean? And therefore, when, you know, then when he releases Emancipation, it happens at the most tragic moment of his life, he kind of had to make sure everything wasn't going to fall apart, because he was falling, it was falling apart. And I admire that about him. It's just the video, filming that video only days afterwards has always been a most, it's like Michael Jackson fans always talk about, you know, why did Michael Jackson in the Oprah interview tell the world he was dating Brooke Shields? And, you know, an hour later, Brooke Shields is like, I am not dating Michael Jackson. Did he think no one would find that out?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And yet, you know, days later, Prince's coping, like you said, coping mechanisms were very specific to him too. But even besides him telling Oprah what he told her, he, of course, at the same time did, you know, he made that video. And it's a beautiful video. And and I want to say, I want to leave it as this. It is a tribute to their son, and it is a tribute to their marriage and their love they had for each other. So even though it may have been a horrible thing to have to do, you know, it is beautiful.
They come true when I need you. You're
I do think it's interesting. You know, you mentioned that when you presented, you were the first person that day to kind of say anything that might that might be negative. I know that when I started, I was very familiar. You know, I've been a Prince fan for a while, and you know, I've lurked on prince.org, and you know, I'm familiar with the fact that the fan base can be a little touchy. to put it mildly. And so, you know, coming into this, I was really kind of walking on eggshells at first. And what I have found, I mean, there's definitely not everybody likes, you know, everything I've written or everything I've said. But what I found is I think that there's kind of a hunger in among Prince fans to, you know, to dig a little bit deeper and to accept some of the things that are, you know, maybe not as great, or, you know, or are, like you said, a little more human. I think that there actually is, despite maybe the kind of vocal minority who just don't, you know, don't want to hear any wrong about Prince. I think that some of us, a lot of us out there, are really interested in, you know, continuing the conversation, not in a muckraking kind of way, but just being honest, because that gets us a little bit that gets us closer to the truth, I guess. I don't really like, you know, throwing around words like that, but it gets us a little kind of a clearer understanding of things when we can acknowledge the quote unquote bad parts.
No, I think you're exactly right. And, you know, I'm sure many people thought it was odd for me not to cry at my mother's funeral. You know what I mean?
Right.
But I wanted to make that, I felt like I wanted to do her honor by, and I think it's important for me to tell that part of the story too, because, you know, that's how I related to figuring out this big puzzle always about him is, you know, I had to remember about my own self about, you know, I love my mother. I was very, very close to her, and that I was putting on this performance of, you know, saying the things I wanted to say. And I knew if I started crying, I'd maybe not stop. And that's what happened.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I think you're right. And I don't think it diminishes him at all by saying these things. And, you know,
right.
Yeah, I don't think it diminishes him at all.
Let's talk a little bit about this new project that you mentioned before we went on record.
So I'm now LA. I'm known as an actor who does one man shows. Okay, and I've done five of them, and I've toured various theaters around the country. I have one now called It's Who You Know, and it's what it is I have this box with hundreds of famous people's names in it. And right as the show's starting, I shuffle this box of 100 or 200 cards, and usually like 20 of them or 30 of them fit into the box, and the rest of them I throw on the floor. And then I sit down and I tell stories about these stars, okay? And some I've worked with, some I've fought with, some I've created projects with, some I've, you know, and all these crazy stories about it. So if you come and see the show, if I run it for a week and you see it, you know, every night, you're going to see a totally different show every night. Because when I pull the card out of the box, I have no idea what the next card is going to be. Okay. One good example is I have a story that people, Prince fans, like about Chaka Khan. I got bumped up on a plane one time, and I got to sit next to Chaka Khan, and they, you know, like the plane's getting ready to like take off, and they say, oh, please, Chamber Stevens, come to the front, and they like, you know, you've been upgraded, and I'm sitting next to Chaka Khan, and I'm like, oh my God, Miss Khan, I'm a big fan of yours, and I have all your Prince stuff, and I have your, you know, CK album, and she's like, oh, aren't you the sweetest? And we're flying from LA to New York, and soon as the plane takes off, Chaka gets this really tired, and she leans over by accident and falls asleep on my shoulder. And the flight attendant says, I'll wake her up. And I'm like, don't wake her up. That's Chaka Khan.
Yes.
And, you know, and she has this big old wig on, and that wig starts to get hot. And I start to get hot too. And I lay my head on her big old wig, and I fall asleep. And when we land in New York, they wake us up, and she's like, "Oh my gosh!" And she's so embarrassed that she's fallen asleep, and she's drooled a little bit on my shoulder. And she's like, "Oh my god, I'm so sorry." And I'm like, "Are you kidding? Shaka Khan just drooled on my shoulder. Yeah. I'll never wash this shirt again." You know? And she's like, "Aren't you sweet?" And I'm like, "Plus, I'm going to tell everybody I slept with Shaka Khan."
Yeah.
Well, Shaka Khan has no sense of humor, Zach. Okay. Yeah. She did not think that was funny at all. Okay. And she called the flight attendant over, and she said, "This man is going to tell people that we slept together and that we did the Mile High Club together, and we did not. And I never left my chair." And I said, so she made the flight attendant get out a piece of paper, and we had to sign a little piece of paper saying that she never left her chair, and the flight attendant and me had to sign it. Shaka Khan has no sense of humor. Okay.
Yeah.
So I've been touring this show for some time, and it's been going really well. And so I've been wanting to do kind of another story about it. So, you know, for many years, I'm sure Zach, you had the same kind of thing. I mean, sure, when Prince passed away on that day, you got tons and tons of texts and messages from people saying, you know, and you know, of course, what happened over the weeks, people would often say, like, "I used to laugh at you for, you know, liking Prince so much. And now, you know, I had no idea," you know, and they were like, "Oh my God, right. It's amazing," you know. And I started to realize that I was upset, you know, I was obsessed with Prince, obviously, and among other things. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, other people, my cousins, they watch football every single friggin' holiday. They barely, right. Know, Christmas and whatever, and they can tell you every single play and every little 22-year-old and what they're running and what high school they went to. And then they're like, "I can't believe you're obsessed with Prince." I'm like, "Oh my God, you're obsessed with this 22-year-old boy you don't even know." You know what I mean?
Right.
And so I decided to make to work on a play about obsession, and it's called My Best Friend Prince. And I'm just workshopping it now, and it's a story of my relationship of liking Prince and meeting him and collecting the bootlegs around the world, and also about other people's obsessions and then how I quickly learned that I was not even close to the most obsessed person.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and I started going down this path. I mean, I was writing the chapter on the Jehovah's Witness. I'm not a Jehovah's Witness. I've never been to a Jehovah's Witness church when I started writing it. But I was, because it's very puzzling, you know, that Prince is a Jehovah's Witness at one point, and Michael Jackson, and they both, you know, went on this thing. And I'm writing this on my computer, and the doorbell rings in my studio, and there are standing two Jehovah's Witnesses. And they're from the same damn church. Okay?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Hey, I got to tell you this, Zach. At that thing, when I saw Jill Jones at the study, she often said, "I could never," because she was raised a Jehovah's Witness too, and she said, "I could never understand why Prince was a Jehovah's Witness, because their music is so bad."
Yeah. I mean, I've never heard it, but I can imagine.
He's like, how could he stand to go to the Kingdom Hall and listen to that music? You know what I mean? And there's, of course, you know, there's many things on various websites that say, because around that time they did come out with a new songbook, and some people think that Prince might have contributed to that songbook. Have you heard that before?
I have not heard that. Now I'm like, do I need to hunt this down?
I think you need to hunt this down. That there's lots of talk that he might have contributed to that songbook. There's also a very famous series of concerts that Prince did in one night in L.A. He did a rock and roll concert, and there's a place downtown. There's three concert halls right next to each other. So he did a rock and roll concert, then he did a funk concert, and then he did a jazz concert. Okay. And I got tickets to the rock and the jazz. The funk at the Conga Room, and it's much smaller, and I didn't get tickets to that one. But at the end of the halfway through the jazz concert, he says, "I can stay here all night. I don't have any place to be but the Kingdom Hall tomorrow morning." So we're always kind of wondering if he actually did write some songs for those guys. So my Prince. So it's a story. It's telling. I mean, people don't have any idea how not only incredible and how many awards he won and how many things he did, but they have no idea, like, that Terry Lewis and Jimmy Jam, who sold 100 million records too, came from the band.
Right.
You know what I mean? They have no idea that, you know, that he recorded songs from one cassette to another, and, you know, you know, we all have those demos from the early days where you can hear the click of a cassette player where you'd play one and then he'd go, and, you know, and that was one of Chaka Khan's first, you know, one of her big songs that he would end up working with her, and, you know, his tracking down Miles Davis, and, you know, and playing the song that he would play for Joni Mitchell. And Joni Mitchell says, "I love that song. Who wrote it?" He'd say, "This is a case of you. You wrote this damn song." You know what I mean? And there's so many, like, great stories about him that are much more amazing than people even really realize. And so I decided to do a 70-minute play about that. I also it's also about the poster that I'm working on right now is a poster of me, and there's Prince kind of in a little angel thing on my shoulder, and in the back is a little devilish looking Michael Jackson, because I also coached a lot of people who were with Michael Jackson at the time too, and not that Michael Jackson was a devil in any way, shape, or form, but that they had this kind of rivalry between each other. And, you know, and I'm going to tell the story, you know, about, you know, the James Brown concert where, you know, and all good Prince fans know about that, where Prince knocked over the light stand. And I don't know if you saw that recently, Ellie Reed said that, you know, that he'd go to Michael Jackson's house 20 years after that, and Michael Jackson would have that video, and he'd be playing it. Everyone that walked in the room, he'd make them watch Prince knock down that thing from 20 years ago.
I think I did hear that. Yeah, the rivalry. The one-sided rivalry is so fascinating.
So many crazy. I mean, there's literally. I mean, it's really hard to even narrow it down to 70 minutes. Okay,
right.
Because he had so many great, great stories, and I thought, you know what, people. And then what I'm also doing is something that you and I talked about a little bit before. Trying to figure out why the hell I'm such a big fan of this guy. Why has he? I've been a fan in my 20s, my 30s, my 40s, and now my 50s of this man. What has his music meant to me? You know, I love. I don't know if you ever listened to the website, The Violet Reality. Do you know those guys?
Yeah, I've heard them. Yeah.
Casey Rain and Kim, they're really fantastic. And, you know, Kim is obsessed with Michael, with Prince during the 90s, and I'm always like, oh, the 90s. You know,
yeah.
You know, but she's 20 years younger than me, so of course that's when she was, you know, the most. So it's interesting to see, you know. So that's, I think that's what I'm working on, and that's kind of the reason I'm exploring that topic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely interested in hearing more about this as it progresses, because this is something that I'm sort of grappling with too, because, you know, I've been a fan of Prince for a long time, but I've sort of drifted in and out, as I think most people do.
Right, exactly.
And then I think most, I won't say most of us, but I think a lot of us, when he died, got like sucked in this huge way. And, you know, I mean, for me, I've been making a hobby of it and making work of it, which is great. But it also means that, you know, I'm not a person who, in my adult life, I've been like, I've really indulged, you know, fandom. I usually stay like fairly distant from the things. You know, I like things and I'm passionate about things, but I would never have dreamt before this, you know, the last couple of months, I would never have dreamt of attending a fan convention of for anything.
Right.
You know, like I've never been a guy who would go to like a Star Trek convention or that kind of thing. Like, that's always been kind of, I've always just thought, like, it sounds boring. You know, like, what, like, wouldn't you get tired of just being around people who are, and maybe I'll hate it, but I'm going to go to Minneapolis in April, and I'm like excited about it. Just like, and I had to like warn my girlfriend, who's coming up with me for part of it and then going home later. I had to warn her, like, you're not going to see me that much. Like, I think you're going to be bored. Like, you know, and looking at it from her perspective has made me realize this is weird. Like, I don't have like a, I don't have a, sort of a defense, like a reasonable defense for it. It's just something that I feel compelled to
do. But you got to admit, she probably has something like that too, that she goes on Pinterest all the time and has these pens or whatever that she does. That is also that you're like, what the heck? You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. And it's the sports thing is such a great example because, you know, I've never been a sports guy, as an adult, I've realized that's just not the kind of nerd I am. Like, you know, it's like being into sports is absolutely like it's a nerdy interest, but like, it's just not culturally coded that way. But I mean, if you think about it, I mean, that's like all the statistics and it's like Dungeons and Dragons stuff, you know?
It's totally like that. And, you know, I mean, at least I feel like when I'm at least like Prince, I know who I'm liking. I know about right. him. I know the history of him. Like my brother, sometimes they like a person they don't know who's just wearing a certain color.
Yeah.
On their shirt. You know what yeah. I mean? And it's like weird to me, you know, that kind of stuff is, you know, weird. But I think that all, you know, a lot of Prince fans, we do talk about that, you know, I mean, you know, I mean, we're all competitive with each other. I mean, when I met, I knew about Dwayne's book about a year before I met Dwayne. And I have some mm-hmm. common friends, and they were saying, oh, this guy's writing the Ultimate Prince book. And I'm like, oh, come on. Come yeah. on. Really? The Ultimate Prince book? You know? Oh, he knows. I think he knows as much as you. And I'm like, really? You know, there really is a guy like yeah. that? You know what I mean? And then when I met Dwayne, I was like, oh, my God. This guy knows a yeah. lot more than me. And you hear about that on the
right.
I love those guys on the Prince podcast. I mean, they're fantastic. Mm-hmm. And they're always talking, you know, they're always saying like, yeah, I met the guy. And I'm like, who is he? You know, who is yeah. he? What is he doing? You know, is he as smart as us? You know what I mean? And that's, you know, that's Prince fans are like that. How much,
right.
how smart, how deep are you really?
It is. Yeah. It definitely is something, you know, it's just interesting. Like I'm definitely in the coming months as I plan this trip to Minneapolis, and I'm definitely going to be talking to a lot of people just like, why are we doing this? Like what is it? Cause the other thing is that I've met a lot of people in the last, year and a half or whatever, who are, you know, as sort of like obsessed as I am. And these are normal people. These are not people that, you know, you would feel uncomfortable being alone with, you know what
right,
I mean?
Right,
like
they're
socially adjusted, like just regular people. But for some reason, we are all just like super into this, you know, this body of work. And I think that there are good reasons for it, even if we can't necessarily articulate them all the time.
No, you're exactly right. There was one guy who did not show up. Okay. A guy or girl. And I think you should look for him in this, at the conference. Cause you know, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it was, I'm sure you talked about too. It was a weird thing because only days before, or actually, you know, the terrorist thing happened. That was, in fact, I had to fly to New York first before I got there. And when I got to New York, I was like, I have a family. Why am I getting on the plane to fly to? They have, you know, at this point, they didn't even know if he was a member of a cell or what. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
And I'm flying, and you know, according to the map, the actual one of the branches of the university is across the street from there. So I didn't know where we were going to be. You know what I mean? And I was standing in the international terminal, and it was really early in the morning, and no one else was there. And this woman walked up to me, and she's like, "You look lost." And I'm like, "I'm nervous about going to Manchester. I'm going to Manchester." And she's like, "Oh, that's so funny. One of my high school friends just went there last night. Do you know Dez from the band The Revolution?" And I'm like, "Yeah, his wife is my high school friend." I was like, "You know what? That's a sign from God. I'm supposed to go."
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So and wow. you know, and we should talk about that too. You know, there was also, you know, this was something that there is a Prince movie that was never released, of course, which was filmed during the controversy years. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know that about that?
Yeah.
The whole thing like that?
The Second Coming, right?
Yeah, The Second Coming. And, you know, part mm-hmm. of it is a concert, and part of it is like, you know, this whole, And I, you know, this whole kind of narrative, and I got to talk to them about it. And, you know, the whole thing where Prince, you know, they didn't have an extra generator and it blew the generator at the house and all this kind of stuff like that. So I think, you know, even before he made Purple Rain, he was trying to put these kind of ideas all together. I mean, he was obsessed about being Prince. So why can't we be obsessed with being Prince? But there is this guy, you should check him out. He never showed up. But it's about like middle-aged white guys, why we're all obsessed with Prince. Okay?
I am definitely interested in hearing that.
Yeah, I'm like, you know, what is it about these kind of like, you know, heavyset white guys that are a certain age that all like go to these concerts and jump up and down? And The Revolution played, I think, probably their last concert not too long ago in a park in Los Angeles. Mm. And it was like all these pasty-faced white guys who were all jumping up and down, you know, just. And I took my 10-year-old son. He's like, Dad, all these guys look like you. And I'm like, yeah. We're all jumping up and let's go crazy, you know. That's it. Or anything else? Is that it?
I feel like we covered it. Is there anything else that you wanted to get to that you don't think we did?
I don't think so. I think we talked about a lot of stuff. It was really fun. You're a great listener and you're a great interviewer. I really appreciate the opportunity to go on and.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, I'm really glad we could make the time. For
I hope
this.
You had some kind of. I hope you found that told some different stories than ones that have been told before. You know. And stuff.
I don't think so. Yeah, I think that there was some good stories. The Chaka Khan story alone was great.
Yeah, that's yeah. So I have a lot of kind of stuff like that about, you know, the other people, you know, Prince, other kind of things like that, and just you know, to have a chance to be on stage with him and to kind of get that experience, I think was kind of a cool moment too in my life and kind of made me appreciate him in a whole different kind of way.
Yeah. I mean that's amazing. I mean, like I said, it's, you know, I've talked to, I think this is going to be the 15th episode. So I've talked to 15 people and only two of them have ever really interacted with Prince. So, and, you know, now that he's gone, that makes it that much more sort of precious, you know, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was, I think we're going to, you know, I mean, you know that we have, a lot of us have a lot of songs that have never been released. And a lot of us, I mean, you know, I have had a lot of songs from the vault that's never been released. And then when you heard the songs that Dwayne's talked about, they seem like even versions that we don't have. I think we're just getting to the tip of the iceberg about what we're going to be seeing. The whole collection has been actually moved to across the street from my son's school. That's where the actual. So I have a little joke that I'm to all Prince fans that I'm keeping an eye on it. Okay,
it's in good hands
to make sure that they're going to be just, you know, perfect. You know, and I want to make sure that, you know, because, you know, I think we're going to be. I mean, we could have a new Prince album every year for the next 20 years.
Yeah. I'm really excited to see where that, you know, that's the other side. You know, part of me is like, all of this momentum right now is great. And, you know, this is the second year that they're doing the celebration and there's all these conferences. And I hope that this, that this music kind of stays relevant in the, I hope it doesn't become like just a weird enthusiast thing. You know what I mean? Like I hope that, you know, like people who aren't already converts are paying attention, because there's just like, there's so much there to discover. Like there's, you know, the rabbit hole is so deep and it's so rewarding. It is.
But you know, I coach a lot of, like I said, a lot of young people, and sometimes they get very puzzled by, you know, I don't talk to them. I mean, the ones that are, you know, older than 18, I might talk to them about Prince, but you know, right. A lot of them went to see that movie, The Kingsman Part Two, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they're like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, did you see the opening scene? And I'm like, yes. And that's Let's Go Crazy. And they're like, oh my God, that was the greatest song ever. Yes. Where do you see him play that song? You know what I mean?
Right.
And you know, right. I mean, you know, in my studio, anybody that makes fun of Prince, I just say, you mean, you literally all have to do is sit them down and say, watch Tom Petty sing this song. And then when Prince comes and he plays that moment and throws that guitar, you know, first he plays the moment and destroys the world. And then he throws that guitar in the air. And then you're like, what the hell? And then I say, now, who do you like?
Right.
And they're like, well, I like 21 Pilots. Mm-hmm. Good luck. Yeah. You know what I mean? Right. I feel sorry for them.
Yeah.
I mean, not that I don't like 21 Pilots. They're fine. But, I mean, like, we had, that's like, I mean, my God. We had, like, unbelievable that this man could be so incredible. I mean, I like I like Justin Timberlake, and he's great, and I like Bruno Mars, but not yet. They're not there yet.
Yeah, it is like it's not even the contemporary artist's fault. Like it's totally unreasonable that you know that this guy was that huge a star up against like Madonna, you know what I mean? Like, and again, like nothing against Madonna. She had phenomenal songs, but like, it's just a totally different category. There's no one else like that.
Yeah. But there needs to be someone else. They need to have someone else. They need to have someone that's going to be that fantastic. I worked on a reality. I created a reality show with Isaac Hayes. Okay. And, he died before we filmed it, but it was called King of the Bands, and it was kind of an American Idol. Isaac Hayes, of course, you know, he won the Oscar for Shaft, and, you know, he's one of the founders of the Stax catalog and one of the great architects of Memphis soul music. He's actually a king in the country of Ghana. He went there to perform, and they decided to make him a king. And they give you a stool instead of a throne, and then they give you quite a lot of money to build your palace. And Isaac, instead of building a palace, built a giant palace building and then turned into a literacy center for people. And I thought that was brilliant, and I was an admirer of him. And I met him, and the reality shows were hot at the time, and I decided to create a reality show with my partner, Julian, and we called King of the Bands, where bands around the country would try to, get to be seen by the king. And he wanted Prince to be on on the show at least once as a judge. And I don't know, if you look back at some of the, you know, like Matt Thorne's book, and I kind of talked about that, he was almost going to be signed to Isaac Hayes' label all those years ago, but it never happened. And he said, you know, I think Prince may still be mad at me. Okay. And so he sent Prince a letter and, you know, called him and, you know, never, that was right before the musicology tour, and never, ever could get back at him. And so then Isaac and I, we went to see the Prince concert. And of course, what song does Prince play during the concert? The only cover? Soul Man, written by Isaac Hayes.
Right.
Okay. And he's like, he's making fun of me. Okay. He's like playing my damn song up there, saying like, you know, Isaac, you want me to be on your damn show? I'm going to play your damn song. And he played that song basically every single, that was the only song he's played that it was a cover during the entire musical tour, I believe.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was a dick move, but Isaac thought it was. Okay.
Well, once again, thank you so much, Chambers Stevens. It was a blast talking to you. And thank you so much to everyone out there listening for listening. I really appreciate it. Just as a reminder, the contest that I was holding for iTunes and Stitcher reviews is still open. I have received a couple of entries, but I'm gonna leave the lines open for a few more days, and I will announce the winner when I post the next podcast next week. So, you know, get it in over the weekend if you're hearing this now, and I may send you a copy of Dwayne Tudall's excellent new book, Prince and the Purple Rain Era Studio Sessions. But yeah, the responses I've gotten so far are really great, and I really appreciate everyone who has done this. And even if you don't want to review the podcast, I still appreciate you listening. Remember, you can check us out, both the podcast and the blog, at princesongs.org, and I'll see you again soon. Thanks. Bye.